Good afternoon, everyone. This is the Conference Committee on House File 1555 on the Senate, or I'm sorry, on the Transportation, Finance, and Policy Conference Committee. I'd like to welcome everybody today. The order that we're going to do to begin with is we'll go through the side-by-side comparisons, after which there is some testimony involving the issues revolving around transit. I would anticipate that we would be done with the side-by-side right around 3 o'clock. We will proceed with testimony on transit until 3:30, and then we will adjourn. With that, Ms. Stengel or Mr. Burgess, who goes first? Mr. Burgess.
Mr. Chair, members, so we'll be walking through the side-by-side language. First, to orient you, there is a summary document that should be in your folders or packets, and then there's side-by-side language of both the House and Senate language. That's what this document looks like. It's titled Transportation Omnibus at the top. And on the left side, you'll find the House language. Senate language is on the right side. Because it's a House file, that puts the House language on the left side, and it will follow the order of the original House bill. The Senate language is largely in the same, following the same order, but there are some sections and pieces that are moved to align with comparable provisions or provisions between House and Senate. So there will be a couple of spots where the Senate language is out of order from its original. So moving into the side-by-side walkthrough, Article 1 is appropriations for both House and Senate, and that was largely covered through the spreadsheet walkthrough. So we'll be starting in on discussing more detail on page R27 of the side-by-side. And this is a House-only article, Article 2 on transportation bonding. This authorizes a total of $2 billion dollars in trunk highway bonds, and that is spread between state road construction at $1.7 billion, and that's spread out over 8 years, and then $300 million for the Corridors of Commerce program, that's spread over 3 years. So the language in that article contains the bond authorization as well as those appropriations and appropriations for bond sale expenses. And then moving to page R29, Article 3 contains a variety of transportation-related taxes and fees. Section 1 is a House-only provision that modifies the registration tax and makes some changes regarding the rates, the fees imposed, what is included in the calculation of the tax, and the depreciation schedule. And then Section 2 on page R31 now, the language on the House side modifies the allocation of revenue from a surcharge on all electric vehicles so that half of the revenue continues going into the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, and the other half would go into a new account that's being established elsewhere in the bill that provides for electric vehicle infrastructure. And this lines up with a change on the Senate side, but that's actually a distinct provision. So the Senate language establishes or increases a fee for all electric vehicles.
The next section is the Senate-only section.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, the next section is on R31. It's a Senate-only section. It establishes a surcharge of $100 per year for plug-in hybrid electric vehicles.
And then, Mr. Chair and members, we'll be just to orient you, jumping back and forth on House.
Yeah, just that for the purpose of the record, Mr. Burris and Ms. Stengel will be jumping back and forth. So those who may be listening to the record in the future, that's who is speaking at this point. Mr. Burr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Section 3 is the first of a couple of sections that establish reestablish a technology surcharge. This had been in place in the past and sunsetted, and the House proposal would be to reinstate the surcharge. This goes on motor vehicle registrations as well as some titling transactions and transactions involving driver's licenses and identification cards. And the House language would set a surcharge fee at a higher amount for 2 years at $4.75 and then dropping down to $2 per transaction in the future. And then Section 4 is a House-only provision as well. It would increase a filing fee on motor vehicle transactions for both renewals and other types of transactions involving motor vehicles, such as titling and carrier motor carrier fuel licenses. Section 5 is another piece of the technology surcharge. I would also note that technology surcharge all goes into an account that would fund the driver and vehicle information system.
Mr. Chair, over here.
Senator Hall.
Could we have the page number added when you say a section? Because I'm having a hard time following you. Thank you.
Yes. Mr. Chair, sure. So I'm on page R33. And you'll see the page numbering, by the way, at the bottom of the document. And the R's are kind of used as an indicator that this is the page numbering with respect to the reviser side-by-side document, as opposed to the page numbers that are shown in the left and right columns reflecting pages and lines of the original House and Senate language. So on R33, Section 5 is another piece of the technology surcharge. That's House only. And then on page R34, Section 6 has a couple of pieces to it. The first is to increase fees for driver's licenses, both Real ID compliant and non-compliant licenses. And it's across the board fee increase for all of the classes of licenses. This section also includes another piece of the technology surcharge increase or reimposition. And then on page R36, Section 7, this is another House-only provision that, again, addresses filing fees. This would increase filing fees on driver's license and identification card transactions. So there's a filing fee on the motor vehicle side and a filing fee on the driver's license side. And then on page R37, another House-only section. This goes along with Section 9. So this is Sections 8 and 9. Increase the motor fuels tax, and this has a phase-in of 4 increments, increasing the tax by a total of 20 cents per gallon. That would be the rate that it's increased by for gasoline and diesel fuel, and then there's a corresponding rate increase to other types of special fuel that's proportional, more or less based on energy content of that fuel. And then the House proposal also includes indexing of the motor fuels tax, and that would start in 2023.
On page R38, there's a Senate-only provision. It's Senate Section 92, and this is the tax on use of electric vehicle charging stations. And essentially what this does is impose a tax on electricity metered out through a charging station for electric vehicles at any location other than a residential location.
And then moving to page R40, Section 10 is a House-only provision. This would modify the allocation of revenue coming from motor vehicle leases, or known as a motor vehicle lease sales tax. And the reallocation includes a portion going to the general fund at a flat $32 million, and then a modification to the formula for distributing the remaining funds. And that includes an increase in the portion that would go to metro area roads by pulling in both Hennepin and Ramsey County. And the calculation for distributing that aid is uses a portion of the county populations. And it also eliminates local bridge funding through this revenue stream and modifies the formula as well to include small city assistance as receiving ongoing aid. And then starting on page R41, House Section 11 modifies revenue allocations from a couple of state sales taxes. So there are three state sales tax revenue streams that would be changed to go to the general fund instead of to roads and bridges through the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. Those are the state general sales tax on auto parts or attributable to auto parts, the state general sales tax as it applies to rental vehicles, and the rental motor vehicle tax. And then page R44, section 12 is a conforming change. The substantive language is on page R45. This is section 13. This is also a house-only provision that would establish a new transportation sales tax in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. Among its elements, the sales tax would be imposed by the Met Council, or the legislation would direct the council to impose the tax. The rate would be at 0.5%, and the distribution would be 50% going to the Met Council for transit purposes and 50% going to the Transportation Advisory Board. And the language also establishes minimums for how the Transportation Advisory Board would allocate that portion of the revenue. You can see the minimums on page R46. So there's a portion for highways, transit, active transportation, and then a flexible amount. This provision also authorizes revenue bonding on the part of the Metropolitan Council against this tax revenue stream. On page R47, section 14 is a change to the motor vehicle sales tax. It would increase the rate from 6.5 to 6.875 of the motor vehicle sales tax. Section 15 modifies the revenue allocation formula for motor vehicle sales tax, and that would reduce the amount going into the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund and increase the amounts going towards transit, both the metropolitan area and Greater Minnesota Transit formulas or percentages are adjusted in that. On page R48, Article 4 is a House-only article that has a couple of provisions relating to transportation, climate, and the environment. Section 1 modifies the goals of the Department of Transportation to identify zero-emission vehicles, as well as accomplishment of transportation goals with minimal impact to human health. Section 2 establishes a legislative report for MnDOT on climate action and achievement of greenhouse gas reduction emission goals. Section 3 goes along with the goals around low emission and efficient use of transportation resources. And then also on page R49, section 4 establishes the electric vehicle infrastructure account. And this is the account that is funded by the reallocation of the electric vehicle surcharge that was mentioned earlier. And the funds under this accounts are provided to the Department of Transportation to arrange for electric vehicle supply infrastructure throughout the state. And then Article 5 is also a House-only provision, and this starts on page R50. And what I would highlight are a couple of things of the entirety of this article. This has to do with driver's licenses and eligibility to receive a driver's license and some related practices around that. The first piece of this is that it eliminates required proof of status, of lawful status, lawful presence in the United States in order to obtain a non-compliant driver's license. The House language also identifies some additional primary as well as secondary documents that can be used in order to obtain a non-compliant license, so things like a a foreign passport or a consular ID card. And it lists out a number of documents. And this follows the sort of layers on top of the current structure that's in place in administrative rule for providing documents to prove identity, date of birth, and residency in Minnesota. The language also establishes a card marking for not for voting if in some scenarios where citizenship has not been demonstrated. And it has some data practices limitations on sharing data outside of the department that is specifically related to status or lawful presence or not having demonstrated lawful presence or citizenship. The language also includes restrictions on law enforcement actions that are solely based on a card that's marked under this language. And there's a repeal of rulemaking or a limitation on rulemaking that's in place under current law. So that runs from pages R50 through R60. So moving to Article 6 on the House side, Article 2 on the Senate side, this is the remainder of the bulk of finance and policy provisions. And the first of those is then Senate only.
Mr. Chair and members, on page R60 on the Senate side, there are three Senate-only sections, Section 1 on R60 and Section 2 on R61, both direct the legislative auditor to audit the programs and services administered by MnDOT and by DPS. Senate Section 3 on page R61 appropriates money in the data security account to the legislative auditor for purposes of auditing some of the data programs that DPS has.
And then, Mr. Chair and members, sections on R61, sections 1 and 2 on the House side, go along with a couple of other sections that are elsewhere in the bill and align with sections 4 and 5 on the Senate side. So we'll be returning back to this. The essence of this is to allow for data sharing between the Metropolitan Council and Department of Human Services for coordination of the Metro Mobility Program and potential receipt of additional federal funds. So there's House and Senate differences on both policy matters as well as the technical approach in creating that authority to share data. And then on R62, Section 3 on the House side and Section 6 on the Senate side is one of several provisions related to registration process and motor vehicle dealers. This section is substantively identical between House and Senate with a difference on effective date and establishes a restriction on manufacturer chargebacks or withholding of payments under some circumstances. Page R67, Section 4 on the House side is a definition change that goes along with some bicycle regulation changes that will be covered a little bit later in the side-by-side walkthrough.
On page R67, Mr. Chair and members, you'll see Senate Section 7, and this is the first of a series of provisions that prohibit the commissioner from using any trunk highway funds on bicycle routes and bicycle lanes. And the same change is made throughout statute to be consistent. So for future sections, when I talk about trunk highway funds on bike lanes, that's what I'm talking about.
And then, Mr. Chair and members, on page R68, the House side, Section 5, and there's another section a little bit later, also deals with bicycles. This directs the Commissioner of the Department of Transportation to provide technical assistance to local units of government relating to the bikeway-type planning. And then also on R68, there's a provision that both the House and Senate carries with policy differences. This is Section 6 on the House side and Section 8 on the Senate side. And this regards establishment of bikeways and limitations or placing priority on preserving disability parking. The policy difference here regards the way I put it is the house is established, the house language establishes that local units of government need to place a high priority on protection of disability parking, whereas the Senate language creates a stronger prohibition on establishment of the bikeway if it would result in elimination of disability parking. There's also a difference in effective date between House and Senate.
Mr. Chair and members, on page R69, I'll take sections 9 and 10 together, even though that's a little bit out of order, and both of these have to do with prohibiting trunk highway funds on bike lanes.
And also on R69, Mr. Chair and members, section 7 is a conforming change for something that will come later. Section 8 goes along with the bikeway planning. This would establish or identify a Jim Oberstar bikeway that would run from the Twin Cities north to kind of along Lake Superior to Canada.
Mr. Chair and members, starting at the very bottom of page R69, you'll see Senate Section 11, and this begins a series of sections on MinPass lanes and changing the number of people from 2 to 3 for the threshold of when you can use the MinPass lanes for free. Section 12 on R70 amends how the revenue is handled from the MinPass lanes. It sort of reorders and reprioritizes how that funding is spent, and it also repeals a separate subdivision you'll see in the repealer later that treats the I-35 MinPass lane a little bit differently. So under this provision, all MinPass revenue is treated the same. Section 13 on R-70 and Section 14 on R-71 are conforming changes. Section 15 on R-71 provides the definition of a low-occupancy vehicle that I mentioned earlier. Senate Section 16 on page R-71 is another prohibition of trunk highway funds for bike lanes. Section 17 on R-71 requires DPS and MnDOT to submit a report every odd-numbered year that talks about their expenditures and transfers from both the Trunk Highway Fund and the HUTDF.
And then, Mr. Chair and members, page R-71, the very bottom, Section 9, with the language actually continuing on the next page, that's actually a conforming change that goes along with a trunk highway turnback that's being authorized in the House language later in the bill. And then on page R-72, there's a series of memorial highways and bridges being authorized. Both House and Senate have several of the same provisions with technical differences. House language has a different, and Senate have different, slightly different names for one of the memorials. And there are some other, as I said, technical differences between the various memorial highways and bridges.
Mr. Chair and members, going past all of the designations, we'll take you to page R-74 on the Senate side. There are a series of provisions starting with Section 28 on R-74, and this amends the municipal approval of road projects. And taken together, these four sections will allow any city to appeal to an appeal board the detour route for a proposed project and the timing of the project. And the timing appeal is if the city believes there is more than 2 years of remaining service life on the road, they appeal to the appeal board. If the appeal board determines that there is more than 2 years of remaining life on that road, MnDOT is responsible for paying all of the costs, including the local shares, for that project. And that will cover sections 29 on R-74 and sections 30 and 31 on R-75 are part of that.
And then, Mr. Chair and members, on page R-75, House only section 17 would authorize MnDOT to create a employment preference, Indian employment preference, for some construction projects that are near a reservation. And then on R-76, sections 18 and 19 deal with utility relocation. They would authorize MnDOT to incorporate utility relocation into contracts as well as limit trunk highway fund expenditures on utility relocation costs for some utilities installed after an August 1, 2019 date.
On page R76, section 32 adds pickup trucks to the definition of farm truck, and a pickup truck is something one of the pickups with a nominal carrying capacity of 3/4 ton or less. Section 33 on page R77 and House section 20 are very similar. This allows a dealer to determine the base value of a vehicle in certain situations. If you flip to page R78, you'll see that there is a difference on the Senate side. The Senate pulls in a cross-reference to subdivision 1N, and that's a reference to the plug-in hybrid electric vehicle surcharge, and then the effective date is different between the two provisions.
And then, Mr. Chair and members, on R78, section 21 is a house-only provision that addresses weight limit violations, variances for some scenarios involving transportation of unfinished forest products. Moving to page R81, section 22 in the House language, section 36 in Senate language, provides for withholding dealers to withhold registration tax payment, and that is identical language except for an effective date difference. Section 23 on the House side, and this is also on page R81, section 37 on the Senate side is one of a couple of sections that authorize decommissioned military vehicles to be registered and operated on public roads. That language is identical between House and Senate. And then moving to page R82, section 24 is Senate-only language, and it's the first of a couple of sections authorizing new special plates or plate designs. Section 24 regards multinational peacekeepers in Beirut, Lebanon, and then section 25 is a special plate for Minnesota agriculture. That's on page R84. Page R85, House Section 26 is a Lions Club's international special plate. And then on page R86, House Section 27 is a Rotary International special plate. And then that, Mr. Chair, brings us to page R87 and a Senate-only provision.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. On page R87, section 38 amends how the proceeds of the Law Enforcement Memorial Association special plates are handled. This will require the commissioner to annually distribute the amount of the funds in the account to the Law Enforcement Memorial Association to further the purposes of that organization. The next section, House section 28, Senate section 39, is a similar provision with the exception of the effective date, and this allows auto dealers to move vehicles in between lots without having to retitle the vehicles. House Section 29 and Senate Section 40 at the bottom of R87 going on to R88 requires the commissioner of the DPS to designate a dealer entitled liaison person to help the dealers. And again, identical except for the effective date. House Section 30 and Senate Section 41, still on page R88, says that the certain late fee doesn't apply to transfers from licensed vehicle dealers, and this is an identical provision. House Section 31, Senate Section 42, has to do with the EVTR system, and it will allow other companies that can transmit data to use this system. There's an effective date difference there. The House has July 1st, 2020, or upon completion of the necessary program, whichever is earlier, and the Senate is August 1st.
And then, Mr. Chair and members, page R88, House-only Section 32 identifies types of data that licensed dealers are able to obtain, which are as specified under a federal data law for sharing motor vehicle and driver's license information. And then page R89, House Section 33, Senate Section 43 is another piece of the decommissioned motor vehicle, military vehicle. This is on authorizing titling of the vehicles. House, and that's identical between House and Senate. And then House-only provision is in Section 34, which would authorize use of a consular identification card as part of the process for vehicle titling or registration. Another House-only provision is Section 35, and this would establish that duplicate titles issued by deputy registrars would be treated as an expedited service, and the fee imposed would be at an amount that deputy registrars typically retain for expedited services. And then Section 36 on the House side, Section 44 Senate side, is a provision on motor vehicle titling and secured parties, and this is identical between House and Senate, except with respect to the effective date. And just as a reminder, when effective dates aren't being identified specifically in the language, because there are appropriations in the bill, the effective date defaults to July 1st. And so where in these various House provisions that are blank on effective date, it's July 1, and that compares with a number of these to August 1 on the Senate language. Also on page R90, Section 37 on the House side, Section 45 on the Senate side is a provision on dealer notifications on secured parties and providing that to the department. The bottom of R90, Section 38 House language and Section 46 Senate language establish Driver and Vehicle Services Executive Steering Committee, and there's a number of differences between House and Senate. The House language includes establishing or identifying various purposes. There are differences in membership between House and Senate. There are some technical differences. And then as there are some specification of duties and reporting that differ between the two. And finally, the House and Senate have a different expiration date that's established. So that brings us to page R93. Section 39, House language, and Section 47, Senate language, is the first is a definition of a term that is part of authorizing automated driving. So we'll get into the detail behind that in a subsequent section. Section 40 is another definitional change that's part of bicycle regulation modifications, along with Section 41, and those two are House-only provisions. Section 42, page R93, Section 42, along with Section 43 on the House side, Sections 48 and 49 on the Senate side, again, relate to definitions for automated vehicles. There are differences between House and Senate on some of the automated vehicle regulation. You see the beginning of that in the highly automated vehicle definition. So there are a number of policy differences. One of the highlights here is on whether a operator has to be physically present in the vehicle or not. Moving to page R94, this also relates to automated vehicles. This is House Sections 44 and 45, Senate Sections 50 and 51. These are also definitions of terms.
On page R94, Section 52, you will see a definition of motorized foot scooter, and the diameter of the wheel is increased there, and the effect of that is it will pull in additional motorized foot scooters that will be subject to the state law.
And then on R94, House Section 46 is another term definition that relates to bicycle regulations changes that are later in the bill. Section 47 on the House language, Section 53 on the Senate language. These are definitions of terms. Again, the first of a series of definitions and substantive language that go together. And this overall provides for authority for testing, or I'm sorry, for platooning, motor vehicle platooning. And this part is identical between House and Senate. Moving to page R95, section 48, House language, section 54, Senate language, is definitions, and this is one piece of changes to move over law requirements when certain vehicles are on the side of the road. And this was, or similar language was enacted actually just recently this session. Section 49 is a house-only provision that modifies a residential roadway definition, expanding it to include other types of or other segments of road. This would have the effect of allowing local units of government to set 25-mile-per-hour speed limits in areas that are zoned for housing but aren't classified as collector or arterial streets. Still on page R95, section 50 on the House side, section 55 on the Senate side is another definition that goes along with the motor vehicle move over law requirements. And then section 51 on the House side, 56 on the Senate side is another term definition for vehicle platooning. And then we're back to automated vehicles. This is section 52 in the House language and section 57 in the Senate language. The technical approach is different. Arguably the essence of the policy goal is similar between House and Senate on this, and it establishes it concerns the rights and duties or power traffic law requirements for operators that are involved with autonomous vehicles. At the bottom of page R95, section 53 in the House language and section 58 in the Senate language modify requirements for stopping for work zone flaggers, and particularly in allowing for peace officers to issue citations under some circumstances when a motor vehicle operator hadn't followed the directions of a flagger. And there are a couple of clarifying provisions that are different between the House and Senate language.
Mr. Chair and members, on page R96, Senate Section 59 is the Senate-only provision. This allows a person to go 5 miles an hour over the speed limit on a multi-lane road when passing another vehicle. Section 60 on page R97 allows cities to establish speed limits other than those in the state law on city streets. On page 98, Senate Section 61 has provisions about people not driving in the furthest left-hand lane unless one of the exceptions applies. And if you are driving in that lane and you're passing somebody, you need to move back into the right-hand lane as quickly as possible.
And then, Mr. Chair and members, on page R99, the House Section 54 is one of the bicycle regulations changes.
Yeah.
This has some modernization of language as well as modifying the requirements around passing a bicyclist. This would have the effect of aligning with a change that was made a couple of years ago regarding spacing. Distance when passing a bicyclist.
Mr. Chair, members, on page R99, Senate Section 62 is Senate only, and this is one of two provisions in the bill that have to do with large vehicles like semis and how they handle roundabouts. This section allows large vehicles to deviate from their lanes when going through a roundabout. House Section 55 and Senate Section 63 on page R100 are a platooning provision that exempt vehicles in a platoon from the following distance law. Also on page R100, House Section 56, Senate Section 64. This is the passing authorized vehicle provision that Mr. Burris mentioned earlier. And essentially, it groups together a current subdivision and an additional subdivision that's later repealed. together and calls them all authorized vehicles and requires people to move over or slow down when they're passing one of these vehicles that stopped on the side of the road with their lights on. You'll see that there are a few differences in paragraph F on page R101 and the effective date. On page R101 at the bottom, House Section 57 and Senate Section 65 has to do with school buses. When a school bus, it allows a school bus that's traveling in the right-hand lane to pick students up to re-enter the lane of traffic without actually having to turn right. Section 66 on the Senate side on page R102 is the other provision about semis and roundabouts, and this governs when there are two of them next to each other, which one of them has to yield the right-of-way.
And then, Mr. Chair and members, on page R102, section 58 is another piece of the bicycle regulation changes, and this clarifies that the operator of a bicycle on a shoulder has to follow traffic rules in the same way as if operating in a lane of a road. It also includes a technical change that centralizes the rights and duties language. So that paragraph B is being added in this subdivision and removed from the following a language in the following section, which is section 59. So that section 59 is also on page R102, and that's another piece of the bicycle regulation changes and modifies some of the bicycle riding rules. And then moving to page R103, section 60 on the House side and section 67 on the Senate side, this is the first of a series of sections regarding on-track equipment that operates on rails and changing the motorist stopping requirements to treat the on-track equipment in the same manner as trains. So that extends to House sections 61, 62, and 63, as well as Senate sections 68, 69, and 70. And that language is identical between House and Senate. And then moving then to page R106, section 64 on the House side and section 71 on the Senate language relate to school bus operation and would allow school buses to re-enter, go through an intersection from a right-hand turn lane without having to turn right when it's part of loading or unloading children. That is identical language between House and Senate. On page R107, section 65 in the House language, section 72 Senate language modifies the colors for part of a school bus to allow for additional coloring. Section 66 in the House language and section 73 Senate language allows for company signs to be mounted in transportation network company vehicles. So this would be Uber, Lyft, for instance, and would allow for illuminated signs. That is identical language between House and Senate. Section 67 on House and Senate section 74 modify standards for warning lamps that solid waste vehicles use and add in recycling vehicles to utilize those standards as well. The language is the same between House and Senate except with respect to the effective date. And then at the very bottom of page R107, House Section 68, Senate Section 75 relate to window tinting and have some technical changes and also an authorization. The substantive piece is to authorize additional drivers of a vehicle that's been tinted. And the House and Senate have a difference in regards to who the expanded authorization applies to. So House, in both House and Senate identify a number of folks And the house also pulls in grandchildren and personal care attendants. Page R110, house section 70, allows for towing two trailers or two semi-trailers under some circumstances involving inventory of property being transported from a manufacturer or dealer.
On page R10, Mr. Chair and members, section 77 on the Senate side is the first of two sections that modify seasonal and load restrictions for sewage septic tank trucks if they're hauling on their routes. The next section that starts on the bottom of page R110 and carries over onto page R111, the first subdivision is similar in that the restriction is removed on line 6612 of the Senate, so a vehicle with this special three-unit vehicle permit and some of the other permits in that same section can be traveling anywhere on Trunk Highway 53. And I'll let Mr. Burris handle the rest of that section.
Mr. Chair and members, and then the House language has a couple of other modifications to it. The first is to specify the types of commodities that can be transported under both the three-unit and two-unit special permits to identify paper products and iron ore tailings. And then second, the House language, and you'll see this on page R112, retains the current routing that's permitted under a special tire hauling permit. That's a separate permit, but is codified in the same section. And then moving to the bottom of page R112, there's a series of sections that have similar language but with a policy difference between House and Senate, and this concerns another special permit for transporting agricultural products. This is section 72, 73, and 74 on the House side, and sections 79, 80, and 81 on the Senate side. Both House and Senate create a definition for what constitutes the agricultural products that can be transported. The Senate language includes some additional commodities. There are also technical differences in structure between House and Senate.
The next section, section 82 on page R114, is the companion for the sewage septic hauling trucks, and it makes some of those exemptions I mentioned earlier. The next section, House Section 75, Senate Section 83, on the very bottom of page R114 that carries on, has to do with vehicle platoons. And at a very high level, it allows the commissioner to approve plans for vehicles, up to three vehicles, to operate in a platoon system. The required information is largely the same. There are a few differences on the process, on how it works, and how things are approved or not approved. And I think I'll just leave it at that, and we can talk in detail if people have questions.
And then, Mr. Chair and members, on page R116, House Section 76 is the first of a series of sections that overall have the effect of limiting the scenarios or situations where somebody's driver's license can be suspended, so that the result of the series of changes is that DPS would not be able to suspend a driver's license for failure to appear in court, resuspend for a violation of driving after a suspension or revocation, or suspend for failure to pay traffic tickets. The language also includes a driver's license reinstatement provision for retroactive type reinstatement and some requirements on data collection and legislative reporting. So there's a series of sections that will come up interspersed later in the side-by-side language. And then also at the bottom of page R116, section 77 and 78 create definitions of terms for an authorization of third-party testing program. The substantive language comes up a little bit later. Section 79 on page R17 is a conforming change, and that goes along with a driver's license modification that's house only. That'll come up in a minute here. Section 118, House Section, or I'm sorry, page R118, House Section 80, allows for placement of an identifier on a driver's license or identification card regarding autism or mental health. Section 81 allows for emergency contacts to be identified as part of a person's driving record. And that's also a House-only provision. Page 119, sections 82 and 83 are part of the driver's license suspension provisions that I discussed. Then also on R119, section 84 is another driver's license suspension prohibition change. Moving to page R120, House Section 85, Senate Section 86 contains the substantive language on authorizing third-party testing for school bus operators. And then House-only provision is in Section 86. This is also on page R120. It's another piece of the driver's license suspension provisions. And this is the reporting requirements. And then page R122, House-only Section 87, directs MnDOT to create a statewide prioritization project process for development and identification of transportation projects. And it lays out some of the factors in the prioritization and requires assignment of weighting, as well as requiring solicitation of input from various stakeholders. Another House-only provision is in Section 88. This is also on page R122, and this directs MnDOT to maintain an inventory of transportation-related assets.
On page 122, Mr. Chair and members, Senate Section 87 requires the Commissioner of Transportation to develop a pavement investment guide and requires the local district offices to sort of prioritize their roads and select pavement in accordance with that policy.
And then at the bottom, Mr. Chair and members, at the bottom of page R122, House Section 89 would broaden eligibility for public Greater Minnesota Transit, public transit assistance to include tribal governments. And then on page R123, this makes House Section 90 has some modifications to an advisory committee on non-motorized transportation. It would rename it to be a committee on active transportation. The House language would also specify some additional duties or recommendations to be covered by the committee and extend the expiration of the committee, which is currently currently has an expiration date of June 30, 2018.
Mr. Chair and members, on page R123, Senate Section 88 amends that same section of statute, but to a different purpose. This is one of the provisions that prohibits use of trunk highway funds on bike lanes. And moving to page R124, the Act of Senate Section 89, the Act of Transportation Account, under this section, the money in that account is appropriated to the commissioner for the stated purposes. Section 90 on page, Senate Section 90 on page R124 and House Section 91 is where we get into the substantive provisions for automated vehicle testing. And I'll just highlight a couple of the major changes here or the major differences. The House will allow vehicles to be tested without a driver present in the vehicle, and the Senate requires a person in the vehicle that is able to take over at any point in time for the driving. The Senate also requires what's commonly referred to as gated testing, so you have to test first in a closed facility, then on a minimal traffic geo-fenced area, and then you can test on public roads. There are, in both ways, the similar process. You apply for a permit to test. Some of the requirements and the process for applying for that permit are different. The House has some provisions about notification and working with local governments and tribal governments when and railroads, depending on where the testing route will occur. The Senate has a misdemeanor penalty for driving without one of these permits. The House doesn't have a stated penalty, so that would default to a petty misdemeanor. And then finally, there are some changes to, or some differences on what data should be collected, who should talk to each other about the data, and the reporting.
And then on page R128, House Section 92 modifies the criteria for when conditional appropriation would be available to MnDOT for snow and ice control expenses.
On page R129, Senate Section 91 prohibits the use of trunk highway funds on bike lanes.
And then on page R129 as well, House Sections 93, 94, and 95 relate to MnDOT's rail safety inspection program. And there are a series of changes involving the program. Couple of highlights. One is that additional positions are authorized under the program. The duties of the state rail inspectors are broadened. There are some requirements of established for MnDOT around what the agency needs to do in implementing the program, and then some clarifications and broadening of the assessment that's placed on the railroad companies to cover the costs of the program. Section 96 on page R131 is a House-only provision, and this broadens the uses of funds from a grade crossing safety account to include program delivery costs. House Section 92 is also a House-only provision. This establishes a minimum crew complement of two for Class 1 and Class 2 railroads in some circumstances. And then at the bottom of page 98 on R131, the language extending and continuing into the next page, this is a householding provision that allows for establishes an exception to interstate transportation hours of service involving transport of utility construction materials. On R132, House-only provisions, sections 109 through 103 create an update to various regulations around wheelchair securement and transporting individuals who are in a wheelchair. And it modifies the standards and specifications and identifies the responsibilities of drivers. And then that brings us then to page R134. House Section 104 modifies the allocation of some citation revenue, fine revenue, so that an increased portion would go into the Minnesota Grade Crossing Safety Account. So it's an increase from $1 million, kind of a phase in and two steps to end up at $2.5 million of a portion of revenue that's provided under some circumstances.
Mr. Chair, members, on page R134, Senate Section 93 requires the Commissioner of Public Safety to do an annual report on the Vehicle Crimes Unit, focusing on the revenue generated by that program.
And then on R135, Section 105, this House-only language narrows the requirements around electric vehicle infrastructure charging stations, so that those requirements on bidirectional charging and safety standards would only apply to infrastructure that's been installed by the state.
On page R135, Mr. Chair and members, Senate Section 94 is the beginning of several sections on airport zoning, and I'll tee that up now so we can sort of skip over the rest of the sections later. These provisions apply to local governments near airports, and it amends the process by which you adopt your airport zoning plan. There are some default provisions that you can use from the commissioner, or you can adopt your own customized plan, and it provides how that works and how it integrates with your other zoning.
And then on page R135, there's a number of sections regarding regulation of unmanned aircraft. Sections 106 and 107 concern the concern a couple of definitions of the aircraft.
Mr. Chair and members, on the bottom of R135, Senate Section 95, and going on to the next page, Senate Section 96, are the airport, more of the airport zoning provisions. Section 97 on page R137 is the air transportation service charge, and here the Commissioner of Transportation is required to charge air users for certain things, and one of the differences here is whether the House allows the Commissioner to charge users for a portion of aircraft acquisition, replacement, and leasing, and the Senate requires that charge to be implemented. And then two funds are established to accept these charges and specifies what they are used for.
And then on page R137, House Section 109 again relates to unmanned aircraft and provides for notification and review by MnDOT when there are local ordinances involving unmanned aircraft.
Mr. Chair and members, on the bottom of page R137, we have several pages of airport zoning provisions, and I gave the high level on that earlier, so I'll just, in light of time, we'll go ahead and skip over to page R147.
And page R147 on the House side, section 110 is another unmanned aircraft provision. This modifies what the registration and registration taxing requirements would be for some unmanned aircraft, so that in some circumstances the craft would be registered at $25 instead of the current registration tax for aircraft, and in other circumstances there would not be a fee. And then section 111 also relates to unmanned aircraft, and this concerns the insurance requirements for the aircraft. And then on page R148, section 112 concerns tax refunds for unmanned aircraft systems that are removed from the state, not receiving a refund.
Mr. Chair and members, on page R149, we'll pick up with some more airport zoning sections, and we'll skip over those, and that gets us to page 152. Senate sections 117 and 118 on that page define light rail transit and streetcar. The next provision, House section 113 and Senate section 119, as well as the following sections, House section 113 and Senate section 119 on page R152, going on to page R153. Expand Metro Mobility. The House expands Metro Mobility to Lakeville, and the Senate expands Metro Mobility to Lakeville, Columbus, Forest Lake, Maple Plain, and Ramsey. The next sections, House Section 114 and Senate Section 4 on page R153, are a similar approach with different coding to how data and what kind of data can be shared between Met Council and DHS, and you'll see that actual language on page R157. And that carries on to page R158. A difference here is the effective date. Senate is immediately effective. This House has a little bit of a delay and has an application clause and some provisions relating to the notice requirements the House has in their provisions. House Section 115 and Senate Section 120 on page R158 make permanent an allocation of RAMVEST, the regional allocation of motor vehicle sales tax, to the urban opt-out transit providers.
And then on page R159, Mr. Chair and members, House Section 116 provides authorization to the Metropolitan Council for additional bonding. And then House Section 116 narrows a limitation on use of Met Council bonds for light rail transit. On page R160, House Section 118 directs the Metropolitan Council to coordinate and implement bus deployment and routing based on the air quality identified through modeling and air quality monitoring data.
On page R160, Senate Section 121 prohibits state funds for being used for light rail lines or extensions, beginning with Southwest is covered by current law, but anything after that. And there's a definition of operating costs. On page R161, Senate Section 122, state money cannot be used for capital cost of a light rail project.
And on page R161, House Section 119 broadens a liability limits provision for co-located freight rail and light rail. This would have the effect of including the Bottineau light rail transit line in that in those liability limits provisions. Section 120 in the House and Senate Section 141 regard a expansion of a U of M Met Council initiative on zone passes, and there are some policy differences between House and Senate. Both have the effect of expanding the number of stops by at least one. It's just some differences in coding of the requiring or establishing the program as well as in how the funding would work. House Section 121 is a data collection provision that relates to the driver's license suspension provisions. And then also at the bottom of page R161, House Section 122 modifies a rest area in Floodwood so that the city would not need to operate and maintain that property. Moving to page R164, House-only sections 123 and 124 extend a pilot program in Two Harbors for community destination signs.
On page 164, Senate Section 123 extends the moratorium on ditch mowing permit enforcement until April 30th, 2020. Section 124 is another provision related to the dedicated fund expenditure report that we talked about earlier, and this requires an interim report before the first report is due in 2021. On page R165, Senate Section 125, there are some administrative provisions relating to the DVS Executive Steering Committee and how they should get started. Senate Sections 126 and 127 allow the City of Burnsville and the City of Minneapolis to prohibit engine braking or jake braking on specified highways in each of their respective cities. On R166, Senate Section 129, there is some signage and funding, signage for a rail crossing in Anoka, and they request the commissioner to make it a priority to find funding to fix that crossing. Section 133 is a public awareness campaign for the Keep Right Driving provisions we talked about earlier. Section 134 requires the Commissioner of MMB to reduce appropriations to MnDOT and DPS in the amount of unfilled FTE positions over a certain period. Section 135 requires MnDOT to do an RF request for information for a private entity to operate MnPass. Moving to page 167, House Section 125, Senate Section 137 allows the Commissioner of DPS in consultation allows the commissioner to issue temporary motor vehicle permits for up to 180 days. The Senate language requires the commissioner to consult. Sorry, this was the commissioner of MnDOT, not DPS. Requires MnDOT to consult with DPS, and the House language requires approval of DPS. Section 132 is some transition language for the prescription window glazing that we talked about earlier.
And then, Mr. Chair, members, on page R168, Section 127 on the House side, this is another piece of the driver's license suspension. This is the reinstatement language. And then also on R168, House Section 128 provides for conveyance of MnDOT property that's currently part of State Rail Bank. And then moving to R169, House Section 129 provides for a turn back of a route that runs through South St. Paul. Also on R169, House Section 130 and Senate Section 130 provides for facilitated meetings between the Met Council and Calhoun Isles Condominium Association. This language is identical between House and Senate except for the effective date. On R-170, House-only Section 131 directs the City of Minneapolis to provide rail safety meetings during the construction of the Southwest Light Rail Transit Line. House Section 132 and Senate Section 128 require establishment of signage to identify the location of the Minnesota State Academy for Deaf and Minnesota State Academy for the Blind, and sets prohibitions on sign removal. There's a technical difference as well as a requirement difference on funding between House and Senate. Also on page R-170, House Section 133 establishes a mileage-based user fee pilot program, sets out the objectives of the program, provides for authority for MnDOT to administer, lays out data requirements, and sets up a legislative report. Page R-172 is the next provision. This is a House-only provision, Section 134, and this would require a study that's performed or contracted by the Commissioner of Public Safety to look into the impact of traffic laws and whether there's been a disproportionate impact based on geographic area, demographic groups. It lays out various requirements around the study. And then on page R-173, there's a legislative report required of MnDOT. This is a House-only provision found in Section 135 and would direct MnDOT to look at legislative reporting in consultation with a variety of stakeholders that are identified in the language, and take a look at informational gaps as well as similar information that's provided in other formats, and provide that information back to the legislature. And then on page R-174, Section 136 contains a couple of revisers' instructions for technical ratifications of language on provisions that have been discussed earlier.
Mr. Chair and members, on page R-174, you will see Senate Section 138, and that transfers jurisdiction of the Stone Arch Bridge from the Commissioner of Transportation to the City of Minneapolis by July 1st. On the bottom of R-174, Senate Section 39 sets up a vehicle registration task force, and this task force will study different methods for vehicle registration over the interim and report back to the legislature next year. On page R-176, there is a requirement that a vibration susceptibility study be conducted on the Calhoun Isles property in Minneapolis. On page R-177, House Section 137 and Senate Section 142 provide various repealers relating to provisions that we've talked about earlier. I will note, at least on the Senate side, paragraph E repeals the expiration of the Mississippi River Parkway Commission, and there's no corresponding policy language before that. And I think Mr. Burrows might have something to add to that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, there are a couple of repealers that don't go along with prior language on the House side. So this is Section 137, House language. Paragraph B repeals a required Office of the Legislative Auditor review of Met Council transportation financials. And paragraph C repeals a limitation on planning, study, and design and construction of commuter rail in the Dab Patch corridor.
And finally, Mr. Chair, on page 177, Senate Section 143, there are effective dates and application provisions that apply to all the airport zoning provisions we talked about earlier.
Thank you, Ms. Stengel. Thank you, Mr. Burris. We are going to move now into taking testimony. I note that we're running a little bit late, but we're going to do the best that we can. Chair Slawik and Mr. Shetland, if you would care to come forward, please. Welcome, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Newman.
Mr.
Chair Holm.
Shetland, whoever wishes to go first, just for the record, state your name and position and proceed with your testimony, please.
Chair Newman, Chair Hornstein, and Conference Committee members. Good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to share a few remarks today as a Chair of the Met Council. I'm Nora Slawick, the Chair of the Met Council. What I'm going to do is present remarks, and Judge Schechten, our Director of Government Affairs, is here for questions. So we'll proceed that way. First of all, a diversified and sustainable transportation funding package is critical for the metropolitan area as we plan for the growth of our region. By the time a child who's born today graduates from college, there will be about 700,000 more people in our metropolitan area. That's like moving the entire population of North Dakota into the metropolitan region. Just think about what that would do to our growth of our roads and of our infrastructure. We need to take a bold approach that invests in transit, roads, and bridges. Governor Walz's plan is bold and transformational. He believes we should aim high, and I agree. The governor has recommended a plan that will do several important things. First, it will build 10 new bus rapid transit lines over the next 10 years. This means investing in projects like the D, B, and E bus rapid transit lines. These lines will see limited stops and more frequent service. Fully implemented, these bus rapid transit lines will connect 500,000 more people to a 30-minute commute to work or school and an increased ridership on our busiest corridors by 40%. The A line, which maybe you have been on, goes from Rosedale and Roseville down Snelling and then over to South Minneapolis, is the region's first arterial bus rapid transit line, and it's been an undisputable success story. The governor plans on that success and will create a multimodal network of transitways throughout the region. This means mobility and accessibility for all of us and our 700,000 new neighbors. The governor's plan will invest in technology and transit amenities, including 220 all-electric buses. These investments will increase the speed and reliability of local routes. It also means improved shelters, fare collection, fare enforcement, as well as an improved administrative presence on the system. The governor's plan will also eliminate the structural deficit in bus and separate metro mobility from rail and bus budgets. This means the regular route bus system will see investment instead of being involuntarily harvested to fund federal and state mandated ADA services for Metro Mobility riders. Let me be clear, both of these services are critical to our region and both should be funded just now out of the same pool of dollars. Funding the base is essentially a step backward. We can't add Metro Mobility service without negatively impacting other transit service. In fact, we can't even preserve and maintain our current system with just base funding. Let me explain. As you have heard in our testimony to your respective bodies, the service demand for Metro Mobility has been aggressive with no sign of slowing down any time soon as our population ages. This means that under the current funding program, Metro Mobility is placing tremendous pressure on our bus system. In this biennium, there is so much growth pressure that it is shifting other transit service that has been funded with the general fund onto the metro area transit's share of the motor vehicle sales tax. Those MVEST revenues fund Metropolitan Area Bus, which is the Metro Transit and Suburban Transit providers, and we're forecasting a nearly $200 million deficit to just preserve and maintain our regular route bus system within the next 10 years. That means there already isn't enough revenue to go around. To make matters worse, in the 22-23 biennium, Metro Mobility will need MVEST assistance as well because it will just have consumed the entire general fund base. That just makes the structural deficit for regular route bus service that much worse. You know, as a former seven-term legislator, as a former finance chair, you know, I know that all of you have a choice. I believe we need to move beyond one-time money. I believe we need to move beyond preserving and maintaining, and I believe we need to have a vision and we need a plan to fund it. I appreciate the other voices that are weighing in on transit investment, and even the Minnesota Chamber has said more work needs to be done to address the long-term funding challenges facing the metro area bus transit system. Base funding does not address those challenges. I look forward to working with all of you to resolve our differences and pass a bill that has a vision that keeps our region economically competitive and prosperous. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Shetland.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to speak here. I'm actually going to defer to you and answer any questions that the committee may have.
Well, I appreciate that, Mr. Shetland, very much. I think what we are going to do, however, is we're going to move through our other testifiers. Okay. Simply because we're running out of time. But thank you very much for that, Mr. Shetland. We have six testifiers in the or on the agenda to testify. First would be Mr. Daniel, Ryan Daniel, and if Mr. Luther Winder would both come to the testifying table at this point, and I'll just kind of shuffle you through. Welcome, Mr. Daniel.
Thank you.
If you would state your name for the record, with whom you are associated, and proceed with your testimony. And for the current testifiers and those that are coming up, please understand that we were hoping to get you up here at 3 o'clock, and so just try to be respectful of the time. Mr. Daniel.
Ryan Daniel, CEO, St. Cloud Metrobus. Chair and committee members, thank you for taking the opportunity to hear me today. I have handouts for you.
If we could have Paige hand them out, thank you very much.
I am testifying today on behalf of the Minnesota Public Transit Association, known as MIPTA. MIPTA advocates for high-quality service that is accessible and available to people in communities, large and small, urban, suburban, and rural, to achieve a statewide balanced system of multimodal transportation. Today, I will speak to the needs in Greater Minnesota. With employment growth in regional centers and aging populations, Minnesotans are asking for longer hours of service so they can use transit in the evenings and on weekends, and as well as expanded service areas. The amount of service that Minnesota transit systems can provide is closely tied to the amount of funding provided by the state. In 2017, state funding covered approximately 65% of the transit system operating costs. Our large urban systems, Duluth, Rochester, St. Cloud, Moorhead, have the same pressures to meet ADA requirements as the Twin City metropolitan area. Our rural systems are in the midst of developing local five-year plans to provide a more complete picture than the state plan alone can provide. Each five-year plan establishes a vision and details on service improvements, allowing transit systems to develop better year-to-year budgets, and assist our communities in planning ahead for their required local share of investment. In addition, this process will help systems better deliver service and work towards overall goals such as improved coordination of services and increased ridership usage across the network. Systems across the state have a need for new buses, technology upgrades, staffing shortages, and facilities. Therefore, MIPTA strongly supports the House investment for Greater Minnesota. For context, the projections to meet 90% of the public transit needs by 2025, as outlined in the 2017 Greater Minnesota Transit Investment Plan, requires an average annual of $22.8 million. Bus service is affordable, flexible, and cost-effective. When people have access to transit, they are able to stay employed and remain independent members of their communities, saving the state millions in health and human services expenses. Where transportation goes, the community grows. MIPTA has always supported a multimodal transportation funding package and continues to do so. Buses need safe, well-maintained streets and bridges, as well as bicycles and pedestrians. Thank you for taking the time to hear from me today to talk about the need for increased investment.
Thank you, Mr. Daniel. If we have next Patsy Murphy, if she would make her way down to the testifying table. I'd recognize Mr. Winder. Please proceed with your testimony.
All right. Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Luther Winder. I also have a handout as well. I'm representing the Suburban Transit Association, and I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Valley Transit Authority, which is one of the four transit agencies within the Suburban Transit Association. The other three agencies are Maple Grove, Plymouth Metrolink, and Southwest Transit. We provide service to the following cities, which I think is important to note: Apple Valley, Burnsville, Chanhassen, Chaska, Eagan, Eden Prairie, Maple Grove, Plymouth, Prior Lake, Savage, Rosemont, and Shakopee. Our almost 6 million trips a year connect people to the urban core and the suburbs for work, entertainment, and daily life activities, and are a part of the fabric that has helped this region to grow and thrive. We'd like to share some of our concerns with the current proposals. We're concerned that the bills as currently drafted, do not provide adequate statutory dedicated funding to allow the Suburban Transit Association providers to invest and modernize in the regional transit system. The STA estimates an investment of $17 million to modernize and expand to meet the needs of the residents we serve within the region. Some of our agencies have substantial needs to modernize and repair garages to meet ADA requirements, as well as a state of repair, as well as needs to repair some of our mini parking decks. In addition, investment and sustainable funding is needed for new service concepts like the Maple Grove Route 784, which is hourly service between Starlight Transit Center and Brooklyn Park to Maple Grove Transit Center. It will provide a critical link for employment opportunities for residents within the region, as well as services like the Southwest Service in the Southwest Service Area, the new Prime MD service. That'd be extension of the current successful and cost-effective Prime service, which is similar to a delivery of a shared ride Uber-type, Lyft-type service now, to provide non-emergency medical trips. That service will provide a critical link for transit-dependent riders that are elderly, as well as transit-dependent to medical appointments. Other services, like some of our existing services, like continuing the existing Route 495, provided by MBTA. That serves Mall of America, Burnsville Transit Station, Marshall Road Transit Station, Amazon and Mystic Lake in Scott County. The suburb-to-suburb route is now MBTA's fastest-growing route and accounts for over 4% of our total ridership. The service has higher average weekend ridership than weekday, which shows that individuals are now traversing in suburbs, obviously on non-traditional work shifts, they need to get to the appointment on the weekends. It's important to note that existing funding constraints prevent three of the four suburban providers from providing late night service, and the vast majority of our communities receive no weekend service at all. Also, there's new other concepts like the new MBTA concept providing a circular service connecting affordable housing in Scott and Dakota County. What we've seen is an increase in affordable housing that's moved out in the suburbs with no transit link. We want to connect them to transit centers for better access to employment and daily life activities, something that many of those sites don't have now. STA recognizes the critical need for more transit funding, but equality and budgetary certainty are critical concerns for STA members. We are thankful for the support we've received from legislators from both parties for the understanding for the need for a strong and robust bus system, but that system should include suburban providers. In closing, and we talked about the 700,000 new people, that's actually part of mine. In closing, the Thrive MSP 2040 Transportation Policy Plan expects the population in the suburban transit provider service area to increase by an average of 36% by 2040, compared to 29% growth in the region overall. So a lot of those individuals will be traversing and be living in the suburban communities. We need sustainable funding that's statutorily dedicated, just like the Corps, to maintain our services and to meet the demand that we're going to see for the future as well. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Winder. Is Patsy Murphy in the audience? If you would please approach the testifying table. And also Mr. Michael Lopez, if he is in the audience, please come to the testifying table. Ms. Murphy, identify yourself, please, for the record. Welcome to the committee. Tell us with whom you are associated and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Patsy Murphy. I live in Bloomington townhome that I co-own with my best friend. When I was 26, I experienced a traumatic brain injury, a TBI, that left me in a coma for 4 days. Now, that was in 1991. Today I still suffer from the long-term effects of my TBI. I have short-term memory problems, communication difficulties, including aphasia, and I find it difficult to stay organized and on track with tasks. All of these make using public transportation and driving dangerous for me. Even though I may look normal, I cannot navigate a bus route or get to where I need to safely. Fortunately, Minnesota provides accessible transportation in the form of Metro Mobility. This service lets me get out into the community and supports my independence. I can get to where I need to be without relying on friends or family to drive me. I have been using Metro Mobility for the past 20 years, and I'm here to tell you it's not a perfect system. We don't have time for all of the ins and the outs, but I want to give you an example. I come to the Capitol every Tuesday with the Minnesota Brain Injury Alliance and use Metro Mobility to get here. Getting here for a three-hour event takes me from 6:30 in the morning until 5 p.m. Now remember, that's over 10 hours just to be here for 3 hours. Please support funding for improvements to the transit, especially for programs like Metro Mobility, which are a lifeline to people like me. Finally, I'd like to ask you to support my friend Mitchell. His idea to include emergency contact information on the driver's licenses is included in the House language. If this had been in place at the time of my injury, my loved ones would have been notified far sooner and been able to help advocate for me while I was in a coma. Thank you for all your work to improve transportation in Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Murphy. If Mr. Grilly would come to the testifying table, next on the list to testify is Mr. Lopez. If you would identify yourself, please, and proceed.
Yes. Hello and good day. My name is Michael Lopez. I'm a resident entrepreneur and business owner here in St. Paul. 840 Selby is my new address for my business and residence. I have been in transportation for most of my life, starting at the age of 13. Today I have a patented product for transportation equipment aid to alleviate the ergonomic stresses of lifting, reaching, pulling, pushing, and carrying while unloading trucks. I also have a commercial driver school called Commercial Driver Training Employment Company, which is new to Minnesota, registrar's office, and also fulfilling a great need and the greatest deficit that we've seen for commercial drivers in American history. With the amount of 250,000 bodies missing from trucks is why the automation of truck driving is being discussed. And before we give away all these opportunities and jobs to machines, I'd like to have an opportunity to provide it to working, hardworking people, especially for the state of Minnesota, seeing a great deficit, not just for drivers, but for unemployment. Our business model will support local businesses as well and help increase the opportunities for public transportation. For all the stories that have come before me today, our business model is very straightforward. We want to enhance our community and the community in which we live and provide our services. At this juncture, I'd like to also speak specifically about the light rail. I've seen a lot of different dangers just in the on university alone. One of the things I want to mention today is that enhanced safety is something I've noticed, especially as a commercial driver, instructor, and school owner. Safety is integral and the only thing I really teach on. I would like to also offer a couple of ideas to the body here today. That might generate revenue for the state and the cities between Minneapolis and St. Paul. By Minnesota being one of the featured places for bike rides and scenic views, I am extensively encouraging that we invest more into that infrastructure so that folks like me and my business interests, when they come in town, have an opportunity to see more than just the Twin Cities area and have the opportunity to see Greater Minnesota on the bike. This is one of the key attractions that the folks that I'm working in business with really appreciated about our state and our city. I'd also like to speak to the lack of skilled drivers on the road, which increases the danger for everyone else, especially those who rely on Metro Mobility and other similar services. I would want to encourage a little bit more scrutiny at the commercial driving testing centers. But at the same time, I also realize that the current scrutiny is creating a dramatic line, wait line, for opportunity for economic development, which is holding back a lot of people at the lower end of the financial spectrum from acquiring and having jobs on a regular basis. I know and feel sincerely about the transportation industry from an aspect of business, but not only that, but for the void that fills, we have perfectly well-bodied and able people, but all we have to do is train. I'd also like to encourage in this conversation healthy eating. As a commercial driver trainer, healthy eating is integral for your safety outside of ours. One of our commercial trucks can take out at least 10 people on the road with one accident. 90% of all accidents happen because of driver fatigue. The driver fatigue is pushed by bad eating habits, lack of proper diet, and lack of knowledge. All of this has to do with transportation very specifically because as you decide what vehicles can haul doubles and triples is what the technical term is for two or more trailers. As you pass legislation to haul certain vehicles with certain types of freight on certain roads, it is very integral that the person behind that wheel is qualified and able to do that work. I can't stress enough how many accidents happen because of an untrained driver or a lack of energy from fatigue by the driver. And I'll end with this. I would also want to reiterate the growth of the transportation industry. What I see for Minnesota initially for transportation as the light rail came in was a great big debacle in your offices because of the legislation and leadership years ago passed up the opportunity to install the rail lines, which created a little bit of a hassle for you. So I'm encouraging today that you look to the future of transportation in general and not just for yourselves but the populace with taxpaying base. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lopez. The final testifier I'd ask to come forward would be Mr. Will Schwerer. And have a seat. I will recognize Mr. Grilly. Welcome to the committee. Identify yourself and proceed with your testimony, please.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Dorian Grilly. I'm the Executive Director of the Bicycle Alliance of Minnesota. The Bicycle Alliance has worked with communities, educators, and business leaders all over Minnesota that want to make biking and walking more convenient and safer. The 60-member Minnesota Mayoral Active Transportation Caucus has two simple messages for you. Bicycling and walking is important, as important, in small towns, regional centers, and the suburbs as it is in the urban core. And the other message is that bicycling and walking should be part of any transportation funding bill that you guys pass. The Bicycle Alliance has trained over 750 educators to teach an elementary school safety curriculum called Walk, Bike, Fun. Those teachers are now reaching 70,000 kids a year. So there is demand that's growing for biking and walking. There are 25 nationally ranked bicycle-friendly communities and nearly 90 bicycle-friendly businesses. And believe it or not, the most are in Fergus Falls, Minnesota, not Minneapolis. So on behalf of these community and business leaders and educators and many others, we ask you to please include the funding for biking and walking that is included in both the House and the Senate bills. If combined, they will help with the needs in greater Minnesota and the metro area. This includes a one-time transfer of $5 million of federal funds into the Active Transportation or Transportation Alternatives Program, and the portion of the House bill's metro sales tax that is dedicated to biking and walking. We also ask that you support the one-time increase of $500,000 for Safe Routes to School and $122,000 for the Active Transportation Grant Program that's in the House bill. We also support the policy provisions that we worked with Senator Jasinski and Representative Bernardi on, and we respectfully do not support the provision that would restrict MnDOT from spending trunk highway funds on bicycle lanes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Grilly. Mr. Schroer.
Thank you, Chair Newman and members of the committee. My name is Will Schroer. I'm the executive director of East Metro Strong. We are a partnership between Washington County, Ramsey County, six East Metro cities, Health East, 3M, and the St. Paul Area Chamber of Commerce, and it's more than 1,000 members, most of which are employers in this part of the state. Thank you for this opportunity and for your hard work to ensure that Minnesotans can get to both work and opportunity. Yesterday, Ecolab, one of Minnesota's leaders in business, hosted a conversation about the new bus rapid transit planned to serve their world headquarters. I'd like to share with you a couple of the things that their CEO, Doug Baker, had to say to us yesterday afternoon. Transit is hugely important. Efficient and reliable public transit helps companies attract and retain employees. Bus rapid transit in particular is a very smart investment, and overall the 3-to-1 return on investment in transit makes a lot of sense. You can read more of Mr. Baker's remarks in the Star Tribune this morning. Mr. Baker was referring to work when he mentioned the 3-to-1 return on transit investment that we just completed with the Minneapolis Regional Chamber. Supported by the Itasca project, we examined the return on investment in transit that we will make in building out the regional transit system and connecting more people to jobs in this region. We found that 3-to-1 return on investment, and interestingly and importantly, the numbers show that most of those benefits would actually go to people using the road system. That includes truckers from greater Minnesota coming to or passing through the Twin Cities. They would see more reliable traffic speeds and lower shipping costs because fewer commuters are on the roads in front of them. We released that study on April 25th, and I have given a copy to the committee administrators. I urge you to read it and would be delighted to answer any questions you had about it. Committee members, there is a strong business case for funding transit across Minnesota. The report, the ROI report also details a number of the benefits of transit investment to businesses in greater Minnesota, getting folks to work at plants there and generating employment opportunities across Minnesota. We urge you to respond to this business case and fund the transit needs that you've heard about here today across Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Schroer. Members, Chair Hornstein and I have visited very briefly. We are going to go until about 4 o'clock. And I will tell you that I do have another appointment I'm almost late for. But we do have Representative Tadke, you do have a question or you're on the list. If you don't, feel free to withdraw.
Oh, I do. Yeah. Thank you.
Representative.
Thank you. It was a question back when Chair Slawik and Mr. Shetnin were on. Yeah, Mr. Shetnin. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shetnin, I just have a question about transit. As we talk about transit and the transit investment, the governor's plan for the metro-wide sales tax has an 1/8 cent sales tax for transit, and then our House bill has a 0.5 cent. For transit, with half of that going to Met Council and half of that going to the Transportation Advisory Board. Could you talk a little bit about what the differences would be between those two plans and what would happen between an 8 cent, well, between 0 and an 8 cent or 8 cent and a half as to what people could expect to see from that type of investment?
Mr. Shetnin.
Mr. Chair and members, Judd Shetnin, I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Met Council. Chair Slawik had to leave. We have a council meeting at 4 o'clock today, so she ran out to do that. But to Representative Tabke's point, the way that the governor's bill works, he has a $1.5 billion plan that that is predicated on the 1/8 cent sales tax. It also invests over $200 million in general obligation bonding. We receive the adjustment from the 6.5% to 6.875% of MVEST, which is common to both transit and to MnDOT and how they receive that. And then we also make the movement from Metro Mobility we separate Metro Mobility from the light rail and bus operation. So that's how we get to that number. There are some differences in between how the governor and the House move forward with how things will be funded in them. I'm going to make sure that I know that Andy Lee is paying attention as well. But what the House does is different than how the governor proposes light rail funding moves forward. I believe that the House bill has the part of the sales tax that comes to the Met Council, Metro Transit, pays for what was previously the state's share of the LRT operations. In the governor's bill, that stays with the state. And so that 50% share, we would be coming back asking for that additional funding. But the governor's plan, I'm just going to restate, does a number of things. We prepare or we're prepared to invest in 10 new transit ways, highway BRT, arterial BRT throughout the region. We invest in additional service, regular out bus service. We also have an investment in electric bus. And so we believe that there is some major investment that we're able to move forward with the investment in transit through that sales tax and those other funding sources that are carried along, which is also some of those are common to the House bill. What the House bill would allow the council to do would be to do additional service, additional expansion in regular out bus. It would probably mean that we would be in a position to do some additional transitway investment as well. And so what that does is it would accelerate, or maybe not even, it would accelerate the additional transit regular out bus service that we would have, and potentially allow for the acceleration of doing maybe two or three additional of the busways at the same time, where we're stacking them one on top of the other. It's just important to state that we both agree that this investment is really important, and we just take a little bit different approach to it. But the House bill also, and I can't speak to what the Transportation Advisory Board would do, but the way the House bill it breaks that out is you allow them to go ahead and disperse that sales tax 30% to transit. I believe 30% goes to an investment in roads, and then you have a 30% or 10%, I believe, goes to bikes, and then the other 30% is flexible. And so I can't speak to what they would do, but that 30% of their quarter cent would mean that's the part that I'm talking about would accelerate that, because the House bill provides a quarter cent directly to the council, where we're at an eighth of a cent, and that's where when I talk about they interact a little differently with how light rail is being funded, and those, it's just really hard to completely explain what it would do, because I don't have a crystal ball, but that's kind of breaking it down to the best of my ability. But the additional increment, the quarter cent that goes to TAB, is something that the TAB would have to decide, but that is new investment beyond what we would be able to do with the governor's plan.
Thank you, Mr. Shetton. Representative Cagle, we also have Senator Jasinski and Representative Hornstein wishes to ask a question. So, members, please watch the clock. I really do want to be done by about 4.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to kind of elaborate on what Mr. Shetton was saying about what this actually means to people in our communities. I represent Anoka County, which has often kind of been ignored by ignored when it comes to transit and roads. We have Highway 65, which has as many commuters on it as Interstate 35, but imagine driving on Interstate 35 with a stoplight every half mile or so. And I've also heard from a lot of our constituents too that to get from Coon Rapids to Blaine, you have to go down to Minneapolis. So when I hear the proposals that Mr. Shetton is talking about, I see the rapid BRT going from Minneapolis up to Northtown, running along Central Avenue, which would really alleviate a lot of that traffic on Highway 65. I also see, instead of having to take 2 hours to get from Coon Rapids to Blaine, we have our families being able to go, on a 15-minute bus ride versus a 2-hour bus ride. And so I really do want to emphasize how important this is to the people in our community when it comes to not spending so much time in their cars and being able to spend more time with their families. I think it's really about the people in our communities and making sure that they have more time to spend at home. Thank you,
Representative Cagle. Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Shetton. And I'm sorry, I apologize. I've been going back and forth with E12 in here. So it's a discussion of 200 new electric buses being proposed. What's the difference in the cost between an electric bus and a standard bus about approximately?
Mr. Chair and members, we had this discussion in the House over at North High School in Minneapolis. I think it was in March, may have been February. But there is a cost increase over a standard 40-foot bus, costs about $400,000 to $500,000. The cost of an all-electric bus is closer to $900,000 to $1 million. However, there is an offset as far as the energy consumption that would come along. And the committee, I know I go back quite a while at the council, and we had this conversation about hybrid buses back in 2001, 2002, 2003. And as the industry brings this new technology forward, the overall cost of those vehicles will drop over time. And so since we are kind of on the leading edge of that right now, those costs are probably about double what a regular bus that we would purchase today is.
So, Mr. Chair, just to follow up, so wouldn't it make us more sense to wait until that cost starts coming down than get it at the high end starting up front?
Mr. Chair and Senator Jasinski, we aren't looking to invest in all of them, after we are able to put together a funding package. They would be brought in as we retire our fleet. As another provision in this bill includes our regional transit capital bonds, which allows us to replace our fleet based on the federal schedule, and those dollars will and so we replace about 10% of our fleet every year, and so we would be making that transition as we go through the process of replacing our fleet. And as folks know, this is a 10-year plan, and it's a 10-year vision, and we think that is absolutely the right way to go. We think that what we're able to do as far as the environment and areas that we talked about in North Minneapolis that have high areas of asthma and pollution are obviously a place that we want to make sure that we are able to run our service without impacting the community and the environment.
Chair Hornstein, I think you've got a question or comment. I'm not sure. Then
sure.
Perhaps you could, when you're done, just give us an idea as to your plans maybe for tomorrow as we transfer the gavel.
Thank you.
Chairman Hornstein.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And this is a question for Mr. Schroer. I don't know if he's still here. Thank you. Okay. Mr. Schroer, I really appreciate this report. I think it's excellent. My question is, what you outlined, I think, a lot of the benefits, the cost-benefit analysis of and return on investment with transit. Have you, in your conversations with the business community or work in the business community, give us a sense of what are the costs of inaction if we just have a status quo transit budget and don't make the kinds of investments that you and the other business leaders have been advocating for? What would the region look like in 10, 20, 30 years if we don't make these investments?
Mr. Schroer.
Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Horn, Representative Hornstein. Off the top of my head, I'd list three that we tend to hear most about. The first is, in the region, we're seeing businesses move around so that they can be on transit. The president of the St. Paul Area Chamber of Commerce and I wrote a piece in the Pioneer Press a couple of years ago about businesses that were moving from the East Metro to Minneapolis because we didn't have suitable transit access for their employees in the East Metro. That's not healthy for the region. We're not losing those jobs in the region or in Minnesota overall, but it's not healthy for the region. We're losing regional balance. We're also losing talent to regions that outside the region that have much better transit than we do. We lose a lot of folks. We used to be the destination for talent kind of off the prairie, if you will. Most of that talent now goes to Denver. And they are very explicit, both the folks going there and the business leaders in Denver, saying, we built our transit system so that we would be that destination. We are now that destination. And they are taking literally our talent away from us. And then I guess the third thing that we mostly hear is the inability to kind of move around within the region. And that's for the people in the region, and it's for the freight that comes to and through the region. So I and you both mentioned in the report the costs of inaction include the inability for product, whether it's windows from War Road or it's agricultural products from all over the state. Those are coming to the cities, both for consumption here and then for further distribution, or they're on their way to Chicago. The costs of delay in those for those folks are enormous, and that's where you see a lot of the benefits from removing those costs. And then there's just the inability to move around the region. Now, we've demonstrated that when you invest in transit, there can be plenty of congestion on 94, but you can still take the Green Line to the Loons game, right? And it doesn't necessarily always fix the congestion on 94, but there's always a choice. And we can build and absorb those 700,000 people that are coming without locking people into congested highways. We can offer people the opportunity to move around, and to not do that. I'll say one last thing, because I know you're eager to both let the chair get to her meeting and to move on as well. We looked back at a similar study that the Minneapolis Chamber and the Itasca Project did in 2012, also called the Return on Investment Study. That study projected $6 billion in net returns for the region, building out a transit system. We haven't built most of those lines yet. We're missing out on those benefits. That's a real cost in avoided benefits to everybody in this region and therefore in the state that we're just missing out on. That's the cost of inaction.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that, Mr. Schroer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you.
And just to conclude, thank you, Mr. Chair. We have posted our next meeting for 3 p.m. tomorrow. That is, of course, somewhat contingent on timely completion of the Regents' session that we have tomorrow, the joint assembly between the House and the Senate. The agenda for tomorrow, Mr. Chair and members, would be that we go over the same and similar provisions in the bills, adopt the same ones if we can, and we'd like to work with staff to see how we can make the similars the same and maybe do some work on that as well. So I am potentially interested tomorrow. We haven't really talked about this yet with the department, but we do have one other entity that this committee funds in addition to transit and roads and bridges. We also have the Department of Public Safety, and I think I'd be interested in maybe having some brief comments from the chairman or the commissioner there about their thoughts on the bill. So we may have some, if the schedule allows, we may have the commissioner come, but we'll focus tomorrow a lot on same and similar.
All right. With that, members, we are adjourned.